Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, February 19, 2015, and this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday. It is a balmy 6 degrees here this morning here in upstate New York. Kind of cloudy, crappy, and it's going to get worse. I thought today the high was supposed to be in the negative numbers, so we are having an actual heat wave. I am remote today. I trucked off toward Buffalo, so if I run into any technical issues today, please give me a free pass. I am working on life support here. Now, I don't know. My father always insists that his computer has no issues except the second I touch it, which it's possible, but I'm hoping that this machine works all right. I see his connection strength keeps going from really strong to almost nothing at all. So if you lose me, I don't know. There's probably nothing I can do here. I do not have the ability to do clips today, so it is going to be a full hour of me making your ears bleed. So where'd we leave off from yesterday? We talked about DARPA's bodily organs on a chip to be able to test drugs on them and see what'll happen. The connection between RNAi vaccines and Monsanto. And we left off the end of the show reading that story about the scientist who had always been pro-GMO. She had worked a good majority of her career on genetically modified organisms and had gotten into RNAi, which is the RNA interference, and it started raising the red alarm that it is very possible that they are not safe. We had compared some of what she was finding to some of the stuff that Dr. Huber had talked about, where he was finding that unknown organism. And that these GMO crops that the animals were eating seemed to be preventing the uptake of certain nutrients. In his little interview, he was talking about manganese as not being properly absorbed by the body after the animals and the plants, mind you. They both were having manganese uptake problems, which is how I kind of figured out that it had something to do with this RNAi, because it's exactly the type of thing that it does. They're selling RNAi for many, many, many different things, but in regards to nutrition, one of the things that we found with some of this technology, now, of course, none of the stories go to where they're going to go now. See, it is because I'm on. One of the things that we discovered is that they say, using nanotechnology, and remember, nanotech is, they could do a couple different things. They can put a nanotech payload, so they could put like drugs in nanotech, or they could put RNA into nanotech, and then they target it to where it's going. Or they could use nanotech to, I don't know, make anything a certain flavor that they want or anything a certain texture that they want. And I'm hoping we're going to be able to dig into that more today. I have probably six more stories that we never got to. New nanotech sweetener that drugs your tongue and is unlabeled. And that's probably the most shocking thing out of everything that we've talked about over the last 5 or 6 weeks now, is that none of this is labeled in our food. You don't have a choice to decide whether or not you want to eat this stuff. And even if you are eating organic food, I just saw a story and I didn't grab it, saying that even organic honey now, they're finding glyphosate in it. All right. Well, along those lines, here's a story I just found. Officials declare eating healthy a mental disorder. We knew that one was coming, just like the anti-vaxxer parents who now have mental disorders because they don't want to get their children vaccinated. Yes, those of us who want to eat healthy have a mental disorder as well. In an attempt to curb the mass rush for food change and reform, psychiatry has green-lighted a public relations push to spread awareness about their new buzzword, orthorexia nervosa, defined as a pathological obsession for biologically pure and healthy nutrition. In other words, experts are saying that our demand for nutrient-dense, healthful food is a mental disorder that must be treated. CNN, Fast Company, Popular Science, and other top outlets have all begun to trumpet the talking points on Q relatively recently. Quote, orthorexia nervosa is a label designated to those who are concerned about eating healthy, characterized by disordered eating fueled by a desire for quote-unquote clean or quote-unquote healthy foods. Those diagnosed with the condition are overly preoccupied with the nutritional makeup of what they eat. Now, you know, I'm just thinking about this. They're poisoning our food, but they're not telling us about it. Just like we knew they were surveilling us, but they weren't telling us about it. And we were just paranoid crazies because we thought so. Now, I just saw a story the other day saying that every hard drive shipped out of the U.S. had NSA spyware on it. And, you know, I mean, we already know since Snowden and all that stuff came out. I mean, that was kind of letting the cat out of the bag on purpose to go, Pah! You know what? You guys knew. Well, here you go. Here's the evidence because we got something better in store for you now. So what they did was then they turned the tables. Then they made it the anti-vaxxers. Now they're making it the people who don't want to be poisoned. And they're going to take every single one of us and turn us into some sort of target that the rest of the herd mentality, yes, I use that term, but not in regards to vaccination, the herd mentality as a whole. So they turn on us, make us ostracized. Because if you've ever watched any type of sociological experiment where you have, you know, one person in a whole room and you disagree, I just saw something not too long ago. It's like 90% of the people actually go with the group as opposed to their own beliefs, even if they know what they believe is true. Don't fall for it. We are the right ones, okay? It is the majority that has a mental disorder called whatever you want to call it. I'm too polluted by toxins. I mean, they have, one of the things that I think I'm going to dig into here after I get off of this nano kick is mind control and brainwashing, because I dug into that for quite a while, and that is extremely interesting, and it explains a lot as to how dense people seem across the board, at least here in the U.S. I mean, in all these other countries, they kind of got a clue. We don't. And actually, we're considered the dumb ones. We're considered the freaky ones. All right, anyway, in short, if you turn your back on low-quality corporate food, by the way, just so you know, my mother does not have a coffee maker. As I take a sip, she got one of those single cupper things, and I don't really like those too much. But my sister, the last time she was here, I guess she had a French press container thingy. So I tried to make that today, and it's actually pretty horrible. It's like drinking coffee beans that were strained through water. So I'm still kind of half asleep, so please excuse me. Anyway, in short, if you turn your back on low-quality corporate food containing known cancer-causing toxic additives and a rich history of dishonesty rooted in a continuous quote-unquote profit over people modus operandi, then you may suffer from a mental illness. Well, then I'll gladly get to the front of the line. The cherry on top is that if you have the pseudoscience labeled disorder of orthorexia nervosa, hold the phone. Of course somebody has to call, and I'm going to hang up now because I don't know who it was. The cherry on top is that if you have a pseudoscience labeled disorder of orthoaxia nervosa, you will be prescribed known toxic pharmaceutical drugs from some of the same conglomerate corporations that you are trying to avoid by eating healthy in the first place. Orthoaxia has not yet found its way into the latest edition of the psychiatric Bible, the DSM, yet it is commonly being lumped with other eating disorders. Stepping back and looking at the ones pushing this label on us shows highly questionable motives. Psychiatry as a whole is deeply in bed with a pharmaceutical industry that makes drugs to treat every one of these disorders. It's even these companies that are wielding influence behind the scenes to invent more health categories with their toxic products as the answer. Of course, we know that. This latest media push to popularize orthoaxia as a mental disorder with a goal to marginalize or derail the food revolution appears to have been dead on arrival. And you know, here's something interesting too. A friend of mine dropped me a Google search yesterday showing how Food Babe, I don't know what her real name is. She does have a real name, but I just know her as Food Babe. And she's called out, she was the one who called out the that rubber mat material in the breads. Remember that at Subway? And hold on. And made them take it out of a lot of their products, not just Subway, but a lot of the different bread manufacturers. Well, I guess there is a massive anti-Food Babe campaign out there. And I mean, really, some of the articles were just pretty assassinating. They were horrible. Called her all kinds of names, said she was absolutely loopy. The woman is crazier than, you know, blah, blah, blah. And all because she cares about what's in her food. So this makes a lot of sense to me. I just dropped that article I was reading into chat. That was from realpharmacy.com. I'm going to read the end of this here. The psychiatric community has even deemed creativity to be a mental illness. I wouldn't doubt that one either. As people continue to walk away from the broken medical and agricultural food system like any abusive relationship, the food makers are willing to do anything to maintain their waning control. Organic and non-GMO food markets have exploded in the last 5 years, so much so that any corporation wishing not to follow the trend risks financial hardship or ruin. In addition, pharmaceutical companies are feeling the strain as a lot less people want their toxic medications and crippling side effects. Perhaps some people take it too far to the point of self-harm, but the problem we face with the toxic food system is a much larger threat. In closing, let's be aware of some of the overall BS fed to us by the pharmaceutically bankrolled industry of psychiatry. And when eating and creativity are mental issues, something is surely amiss. Bravo! Wait, who wrote this? Jeffrey Jackson? I don't know. That was a pretty good story. And I wouldn't doubt that they're going to turn it into a disorder. I mean, all you got to do then is go to your doctor and, you know, if you still trust your doctor, which there probably aren't many of us that do. But if you go to your doctor that you trust and you say, look, doc, I really think a lot of my problems are the fact that I've been eating this GMO food that then has killed all my digestive enzymes. You know, there actually, I had a story about that. It was exactly what I'd lived through for 10, 12, 15 years. But the second you say that to your doctor and you blame it on the food you're eating, they're going to go, bloop, we're going to let you go see a psychiatrist. And they're going to put it into your medical, electronic medical health record, which is then going to have a big red button that goes boop, 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 is not able to own a gun. Remember, after Sandy Hook, when Obama came out and did his 37 or 47 executive actions or whatever they were, one of the things that he did, and he talked about getting rid of HIPAA for privacy. So all these multinational drug corporations and genomics institutes could get their hands onto your medical data. But one of the things that he talked about was. I totally lost my whole train of thought. Wait a second. This is so unconducive to doing radio down here, just so you know. Oh, fuck Obama. I don't remember what he talked about. Let me move on. All right, so we're talking about genomics. We're talking about something not too long ago called the epigenome. And one of the things that I thought was kind of cool, though, I didn't think it was cool that I could get my grandmother's genes without getting my grandmother's genes, is that they said that you can actually pass down experiences. So let's say your grandmother lived through the Depression, which probably most of ours did. Well, that innate, maybe deep down feeling of needing to hoard things, they're saying is actually a kickback to something that was so impressive on your grandmother. It might not have changed her genes, but it changed what they're calling this quote second genetic code called the epigenome. And her experience of living through the Depression and not having enough to eat and always feeling afraid that, you know, she was going to run out of something and being a hoarder. That hoarding ability can actually pass down as well to offspring. For an example, let's say. So here, let's read the story. Brand spanking new actually just came out this morning from Reuters. I had talked about this probably a month or two ago. I had run across some interesting research. It says, map of second genetic code, the epigenome is unveiled. Scientists, for the first time, have mapped out the molecular switches that can turn on or silence individual genes in the DNA in more than 100 types of human cells, an accomplishment that reveals the complexity of the genetic information and the challenges of interpreting it. Scientists. Oh, this is the, they that was up in the top, and they repeated it again. Researchers unveiled the map of the epigenome in the Journal of Nature on Wednesday, alongside nearly two dozen related papers. The mapping effort is being carried out under a 10-year, $240 million U.S. grant for research called the Roadmap Epigenomics Program, which was launched in 2008. Guys, no wonder we have homeless people and people losing their homes and a 30%+ unemployment rate and food prices through the roof. It's because they're blowing all of our money on things that are going to ensure their longevity. But I really don't give two shits about the epigenome, to tell you the truth. But let's read about it since we just blew $240 million of our taxpayer money on it. The human genome is the blueprint for building an individual person. The epigenome can be thought of as the crossouts and underlinings of that blueprint. If someone's genome contains DNA associated with cancer, but that DNA is crossed out by molecules in the epigenome, for instance, the DNA is unlikely to lead to cancer. And yet, the one thing that is interesting, I think, is well, here, we'll read a little bit more. As sequencing individuals' genomes to interfere the risk of disease, to infer the. See. My father's monitor is like halfway across the room, just about, and way up high, and it's very difficult. I don't know. Tomorrow we might have to run a rebroad. I hate doing shows here more than anything. Sequencing individuals' genomes to infer the risk of disease becomes more common. It will become all the more important to figure out how the epigenome is influencing that risk as well as other aspects of health. Sequencing genomes is the centerpiece of precision medicine, boop, 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 initiative that U.S. President Barack Obama announced this month. The only way you can deliver on the promise of precision medicine is by including the epigenome, says Manolis Kellis of MIT, who led the mapping that involved scientists in labs from Croatia to Canada and the United States. Drug makers, including Merck, Genentech's unit of Roche Holdings, and GlaxoSmithKline, are conducting epigenetics research related to cancer, says Joseph Costello of the University of California, San Francisco, director of one of our four main labs that contributed data to the epigenome map. Epigenetic differences are one reason identical twins who have identical DNA do not always develop the same genetic diseases, including cancer. But incorporating the epigenome into precision medicine is daunting. A lifetime of environmental factors and lifestyle factors influence the epigenome, including smoking, exercise, diet, exposure to toxic chemicals, and even parental nurturing, Kellis said in an interview. Not only will scientists have to decipher how the epigenome affects genes, but they will also have to determine how the lives people lead affect their epigenome. The human genome is the sequence of all the DNA on the chromosomes, and the DNA is identical in every cell from neurons to hearts and to skin. It falls to the epigenome to differentiate these cells, and as a result of the epigenetic marks, heart muscle cells do not make brain chemicals, for instance, and neurons do not make muscle fibers. Well, this is very different than the story that I read out of Discover Magazine on the epigenome. The epigenome map published on Wednesday shows how each of the 127 tissue and cell types differ from each and every other at the DNA level. Because scientists involved in the roadmap project have been depositing their findings in a public database as they went along, other researchers have been analyzing the information before the map was ever formally published. One of the resulting studies showed, for instance, that brain cells from people who died with Alzheimer's had epigenetic changes in DNA involved in immune response. It's all about inflammation, people. Alzheimer's has never been seen as an immune system disorder, so the discovery opens up other possible avenues to understand and treat it. Other researchers found that because the epigenetic signature of different kinds of cells is unique, they could predict with nearly 90% accuracy where metastatic cancer originated, something that is unknown in 2 to 5% of patients. As a result, epigenetic information might offer life-saving clues for oncologists trying to treat blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? Oncologists are going to have their self-replicating cancer bots anyway. There is much more to come. Instead of the epigenome being the end, it is very much the beginning of the decade of epigenomics. How nice is that? All about precision medicine, sucking another, how much, $240 million out of the economy to feed Big Pharma. All right, we're going to kill this. I actually want, because that was so off what I had originally read, we're going to take a detour. Burp. Take a quick card right. We need to pop back over and scroll. And there's no easy way for me to find this, so I'm just going to babble until I find it.Ey, Large Hadron Collider is getting ready to fire up in March. That makes me really excited. I read a little bit more on it yesterday as to exactly what the experiments are going to be this time. It's no longer the Higgs boson, Hoag's, whatever it's called, boson particle. They apparently think they found it. This time, they're going to be doing all their research on dark matter. Now, I don't know. From a scientific perspective, dark matter is all kinds of things. From my perspective and just kind of viewing the whole question as to what is out there and where's all the missing matter, and oh, there's this dark matter, but we don't quite know what it is, and maybe it's kind of antimatter, but it's not really antimatter, it's just this really dark matter. And it passes through us all the time. You know, the fact that they're going to start messing with that stuff on Earth, they're going to start looking for dark matter and, I don't know, opening up the Pandora's box of maybe something that we shouldn't even be touching, pretending again that we're gods, yet we don't know how to control any of this shit once the genie got out of the bottle, doesn't seem like a very good idea to me. Not at all. I call that bad idea 6,272. All right, I need to find the story. I'm scrolling, 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 and I know exactly what the picture is. And I must have gone too far. I think when you post stuff, they actually, after a certain amount of time, they start selectively removing your posts. So then you go, I thought I posted it, but it's not there. But it happens a little too often because I have a pretty good memory, except when I'm tired like now. And I can't even play as a clip. So, and I can't, jeez, this sucks. I have to tell you, radio here is just like always the worst radio ever. All right. Well, I'm going to have to skip it because I don't even remember what the title is. A couple days ago, we talked about DNA storage and how they found a way now to store information in a DNA molecule embedded in glass for like a million years. Well, another story came out yesterday, I think, February 18th, yes, yesterday, out of Next.gov. It's an interesting publication. Nextgov.com. But yeah, it's nextgov.com. Not next.gov. Nextgov.com. Story came out yesterday. It says, scientists say all the world's data can fit on a DNA hard drive the size of a teaspoon. Remember I was talking about that? They were saying how, and this was quite a number of years back, they were saying how every butterfly fly flap and breath that every living creature has ever taken on planet Earth could literally fit into a pound of this DNA storage. And I was envisioning it looking like a big Jabba the Hutt. All right, so let's read this one. Even though it's looking increasingly likely that humanity will find a way to wipe itself off the face of the earth, there is a chance that our creative output may live on. Servers, hard drives, flash drives, and disks will degrade, as will our libraries of paper books, of course. But a group of researchers at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology have found a way to encode data onto DNA, the very same stuff that all living beings' genetic information is stored on, that could survive for millennia. 1 gram of DNA can potentially hold up to 455 exabytes of data, according to New Scientist, and that is the publication that we read the original story out of. For reference, there are 1 billion gigabytes in an exabyte and 1,000 exabytes in a zettabyte. The cloud computing company EMC estimates that there were 1.8 zettabytes of data in the world in 2011, which means that we would only need about 4 grams or 1 teaspoon of DNA to hold everything from Plato through the complete works of Shakespeare to Beyonce's latest album, not to mention every brunch photo ever posted on Instagram. There are 4 kinds of molecules that make up DNA, which form pairs. And to encode information on DNA, scientists program the pairs into ones and zeros, the same binary language that encodes digital DNA. This is not a new concept. Scientists at Harvard University encoded a book onto DNA in 2012. Oh, let's take a look. I bet it's that Weiss Institute bullshit. They're everywhere. Well, we'll look at that next. Hold on. But up until now, it has been difficult to retrieve information stored on the DNA. So it must have been in 2012 when I first started reading about this. Past tests have seen gaps in retrieved information as DNA reacts with its environment and degrades at room temperature, but Robert Grass, I thought it said his name was Glass, actually, the leader of the project at the Federal Institute has found a new way to preserve information, treat it like a fossil. And we actually went through this, but I guess for the people who didn't hear the episode a couple days ago, I will read this for you. His team encases their DNA sample in a shell made from silica, similar in structure to fossilized bones, and one of the main components of glass, stored the sample at about 140 degrees Fahrenheit for a few weeks to test its durability. And when researchers recovered the sample, they were still able to read and encode the data. And Grass told the Institute's blog that the DNA had been stored at sub-zero temperatures. It could potentially be read in over 1 million years. So there you go. For now, the process remains expensive. Of course it does. Only for rich people. The DNA sample created for the Institute's test was about 83 kilobytes of data and cost $1,500 to produce, Grass told New Scientist. That means encoding anything worth saving. Wikipedia, for example, or the first four seasons of The Wire, I never saw that, would be prohibitively expensive right now. 83 kilobytes of data at $1,500 is very expensive. As with any new technology, though, the cost of DNA storage is likely to drop. That's very true. And we'll probably be able to put it right into a little DNA module stuck in your thumb. You know, so you could just like scan it on things. You could have like a DNA storage reader. Bloop. It'll be like your little flashcard with all, and they could even put your electronic medical health records on it. Oh, look at that. Ahem. There may come a time when a future being venturing out into the nuclear winter finds a DNA data store and will be able to peruse the greatest achievements of humanity up until the turn of the 20th century. Yeah, all right. Well, so there you go. Everything that at least we've done in the last couple centuries can go onto a teaspoon of DNA. We also looked at the DNA barcoding, which was pretty interesting. But here, let's pop over to the story from 2012. They said it was out of Harvard. I want to see if it's out of the Weiss Institute. Reading and writing a book with DNA. Researchers are storing digital information in the form of DNA, but is it practical? Harvard University researchers converted a 53,000-word book into DNA. Oh, yeah, I totally remember this. And then read the DNA-encoded book using gene sequencing technology, the researchers reported this week in Science. The project is by far the largest demonstration of digital information storage in DNA and the densest consolidation of data to any medium. I wonder, it does. Oh, yes, I was right. And there is a clear need for improved long-term storage of massively large data, says George Church, a geneticist at the Harvard's Weiss Institute. Guys, that place is like the hive. All right, that is where all the evil is crawling out of the sewers, that Weiss Institute. Look into it, spelled WYSS. George Church, a geneticist at the Harvard's Weiss Institute, and one of the leaders of the research. There is data that we are throwing away or don't collect because we can't afford to store it, such as video surveillance of public spaces, of course, and large research projects, he says. But someday that won't be necessary. That's why I had actually envisioned the big Jabba the Hutt pound of DNA storage sitting at the NSA data center. The question is, what will get us there first? Electronic or molecular memory? DNA offers advantages over electronic storage, but whether it will ever make sense practically or economically is unclear. DNA can store more digital information per cubic millimeter than flash memory or even cutting-edge experimental memories such as quantum holography. There's a good one to look up. I haven't looked into quantum holography yet. Data stored on DNA is also recoverable for millennia. And given DNA's biological importance, we can safely assume that it's going to remain a readable standard for a long time. If you look at the size per bit of stored memory as DNA, it is unlikely that we will ever get to that, says Joseph Jacobson. Oh, here's the other pit of evil. Joseph Jacobson, a synthetic biologist at MIT, who was not involved in this project. I bet he's pissed off. But making and reading DNA isn't yet practical. Synthesizing and sequencing DNA is expensive, although the cost for both of these technologies has been dropping at a rate of 5 or 12-fold per year. And the fact that now we've dumped all this federal money into precision medicine, that's going to get around anyone having money to sequence everything. But remember, precision medicine is going to be super expensive. So how the hell are we going to pay for it? It's just them chucking the last of the fixtures out the back door is what it is. We're not going to see this. This isn't going to save you, me, Fido, Fifi. What's more, you know what I was actually thinking? I was actually thinking when these guys are planning on getting off this rock, they'll just launch the nanobots into their bloodstream so any of the damage that they incur from the radiation outside of our protective magnetosphere can be repaired. This isn't for us. Not at all. Maybe they'll try it on the 100 that are planning on going to Mars that they, I guess, finally just made the final decisions on. Anyway, let's get back to the story. What's more, unlike electronic bits, most DNA data cannot be changed once it is written. And with today's technology, information in DNA usually has to be accessed as a whole and not in parts. Church and his colleagues set out to demonstrate a simple way to densely sort data in DNA. They converted an HTML draft of a book comprising 53,426 words, 11 JPEGs, and one JavaScript program into a 5.2 megabit set of zeros and ones. Using software they wrote, zeros were assigned to the letters A or C for the DNA base, adenine and cytosine, and the other ones were assigned the letters G or T for the DNA bases, guanine and thymine. That's the CATG. And remember, something else we had read not too long ago about the synthetic DNA, the quote-unquote alien DNA that they have created, they added the X and Y. So this is going to give them storage amounts that have never before been seen. A lowercase f from the book, for example, is represented in binary, do we really care, 0110110, and encoded in the DNA as ATGAATTC. Synthesizing that string of bits would yield a stretch of DNA that was 5.27 million bases long. Blah, 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 blah. I don't know. Do I really want to go any more into this? Similar approaches have been demonstrated before, but on a smaller scale. The tome that got the honor of becoming the world's first biological book is the forthcoming Regenesis: How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves. The book is co-authored by Church and will be published in a more conventional form this fall. You know, that Church was actually in another one of our stories a day or two ago. He was mentioned because I saw this book when I searched his name. So this dude, he is the pit. How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves? I don't need reinventing, thank you very much. Another researcher who studies the intersection of biology and technology and asked to remain anonymous calls Church's paper a, quote, silly vanity project, unquote, whoops, with little value. It's like showing you could painstakingly use an abacus to solve a Hamiltonian path problem that would take an average computer a microsecond, he said. Other than maybe military intelligence, finding real-world applications for DNA storage technology, quote, under no conceivable set of circumstances is even remotely likely, he says. Other than military intelligence. Remember, all of this is being fueled by DARPA. All of it. Every little bit of it. So it's all about military intelligence. It's all about control. Jacobson disagrees and says that it's easy to dismiss his technology at first glance, but it is clear that there are near-term practical uses, like storing data that requires millions of copies. DNA is expensive to write the first time, he says, but making copies of itself is cheap. Well, that's kind of scary. If you want to replicate it a billion times, and actually that's what they were doing with that genetically modified tobacco. They created their antigens that they needed against, at that time was Ebola, but at another time they were working on a universal flu vaccine as well with the genetically modified tobacco. But then once the plant creates it, then they just start cloning the plant, and it replicates the DNA through every single plant that they clone off of that original plant. DNA is expensive to write the first time. Making copies is cheap. If you want to replicate it a billion times, I don't know of a cheaper way to do it, he says. The food and consumer product industry, for example, could insert, and here we go, ding, 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 could insert in every product they produce a DNA identification tag to indicate the country of origin, let's say, and other informational consumers, other information that consumers might want or might not want to know. Now, how interesting, too, that we're in the middle of this battle of our right to know what's in our food. And they're working on all this Frankenstein DNA science. And one dissenter that comes out, wants to remain anonymous, points to the military and military intelligence as being like the one thing that he sees that this could be used for. And this church, actually this is Jacobson, so whoever he is, comes out and disagrees and points to being able to label what's in our food with some sort of DNA ID tag? I mean, isn't that the utmost irony? Oh, yeah, because Church says he hadn't yet thought of the food application, but thinks it would work. His book's DNA is biocompatible and biodegradable. He says you could eat it. Oh, how great, too. It's biodegradable. So you know what? It's all green and good for the carbon deniers. I don't know. This stuff is just, when I think about this, it just really gets me frustrated. Now, something, though, that did come up in that story made me think of something else that I saw the other day, and I think this means that squids are going to be in trouble. Hold on. I think it was a squid. Let's find it. Find it. We're going to find it. It was only from a couple days ago. I need some DNA storage. Oh, actually, here's a couple good ones, but I want to find the ones about the squids. There's something very interesting that they had just discovered the squids could do. But I don't want to, here it is. Squids, it was squids. They said specifically in the story that we just read about the books is that once DNA is encoded, it can't be changed. Well, that might change. Science Daily released a story titled, Squids Can Recode Their Genetic Makeup on the Fly to Adjust to Their Surroundings, per a study. And how funny, this came out of American Friends of Tel Aviv University. Oh, goodness. And you do know that they're probably researching this because the dude at the Weiss Institute says, well, yeah, we can encode all this DNA shit and all this, but we can't change it once it's encoded. And they said it in Tel Aviv, don't worry about it. We got all your American military money here. We'll start researching it. The principle of adaptation, the gradual modification of a species structure and features, is one of the pillars of evolution. And while there exists ample evidence to support the slow ongoing process that alters genetic makeup of a species, scientists could only suspect that there were also organisms capable of transforming themselves ad hoc to adjust to changing conditions. Well, now a new study published out of eLife by Dr. Eli Eisenberg of Tel Aviv University's Department of Physics and Sengol School of Neuroscience, in collaboration with Joshua Rosenthal of the University of Puerto Rico, showcases the first example of an animal editing its own genetic makeup on the fly to modify most of its proteins, enabling adjustments to its immediate surroundings. Quote, "We have demonstrated that RNA editing is a major player in genetic information processing rather than an exception to the rule," says Dr. Eisenberg. "By showing that a squid's RNA editing dramatically reshaped its entire proteome, which is the entire set of proteins expressed by a genome, cell, tissue, or an organism at a certain time, we proved that an organism's self-editing of mRNA is a critical evolutionary and adaptive force. This demonstration," he said, "may have implications for what? Human diseases as well." Guys, it is just off the hook at this point. All the research is going into this stuff. And I mean, everything that we're reading that they've already been working on and have discovered is scary enough. But think about it. They're dumping bazillions of dollars into this stuff at research universities all over the planet. All right, we'll read a little bit more. "Using the genetic red pencil, RNA is a copy of the genetic code that is translated into protein, but the RNA transcript can be edited before being translated into protein, paving the way for different versions of the protein. Abnormal RNA editing in humans has been observed in patients with neurological diseases, of course. So we are going to develop this technology now to help all of those poor patients with neurological diseases. The changing physiological appearance of the squid and octopuses," I thought it was octopi, "over their lifetime and across different habitats," and they do. They have the ability to do the camouflage like the lizard does. I don't remember what the lizard is. You know, where they can like change their colors depending on their surroundings. And isn't that kind of what they want nanotech to do, like for cars? They want to be able to like change the car color on the fly. Yeah, this is something that they're going to like start killing squids for. And squids are very intelligent, by the way. They have big brains. "The changing physiological appearance of a squid and octopi over their lifetime and across different habitats has suggested extensive recoding might occur in these species. However, this could never be confirmed as their genomes, as those with most species, had never been sequenced. For the purpose of this new study, researchers extracted both DNA and RNA from a squid, and harnessing DNA sequencing and computational analyses, the team compared the RNA and DNA sequences to observe the differences. The sequences in which the RNA and the DNA did not match up were identified as edited. It was astonished to find that 60% of the squid's RNA transcripts were edited. The fruit fly, for the sake of comparison, is thought to edit only 3% of its makeup. Why do squids edit to such an extent? One theory is that they have an extremely complex nervous system exhibiting behavioral sophistication unusual for invertebrates. And yes, there, I watched a video last year with a squid using tools, like holding them in its tentacles to get food. Or maybe it was building a shelter. I don't know. I'll have to see if I can find that one. "They may also utilize this mechanism to respond to changing temperatures and other environmental parameters. The researchers hope to use this approach to identify recoding sites in other organisms whose genomes have not been sequenced." He says, "We would like to understand better how prevalent this phenomenon is in the animal world, and how is it regulated? How is it exploited?" says Dr. Eisenberg. "There may be many implications for us as well. Human diseases are often the result of quote-unquote misfolded proteins, which often become toxic." Now, I'm going to tell you, that the only place that I've ever heard of misfolded proteins was in that CVJD, that Krupp-Jacobs disease, mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, chronic wasting disease. That was all blamed on malformed proteins. So this Israeli researcher is saying that human diseases are often the result of misfolded proteins, which then become toxic. It's the first I have ever heard of anyone equating most human diseases to misfolded proteins. SLC, if you're out there, that's something we need to look up because, and what's interesting is earlier in here they had said about neurological disorders. Well, yes, that is what mad cow, even Alzheimer's, they were thinking that maybe there was some connection to malformed proteins. But I have not seen it equated to most human diseases. Well, that'll be a research project. Therefore, he says, the question of treating the misfolded proteins likely to be generated by such an extensive recoding as exhibited in the squid cells is very important for future therapeutic approaches. Poor squids. They're gonna do in the squids. Here, I'm gonna drop you this story so you can read that. All right. We have only a couple minutes left, and there were a few things that, as I was scrolling down looking for the squid story, made me go, oh, we missed these ones. So hold on. And here we go. We might as well end it with this since I need more. Coffee consumption linked to a decrease in DNA breakage. So keep what you're doing, coffee drinkers. Yay! Before the first cup and after many. If you are a regular coffee drinker, you could be ensuring the integrity of your DNA, according to the results of a new German study. The researchers found that those who drank 3 cups of dark roast coffee blend per day experienced 27% fewer DNA strand breaks in their white blood cells than those who drank water instead. It's probably because the water is so damn polluted. Previous research has shown that coffee consumption can also decrease the instances of oxidative damage in our white blood cells. This damage is caused by an imbalance between the production of reactive oxygen species called free radicals, atoms, molecules, or ions that end up with one or more unpaired electrons, which makes them highly reactive with other cellular structures and the cell's ability to counteract their harmful effects. I was just reading too in one of the nanotech research papers that they were afraid that, and maybe actually it was in the Monsanto one that woman wrote, which we never got back to today, but maybe tomorrow, about how consuming nanoparticles, they believe, releases the free radicals that have been stored in the body. So that'd be very bad. Free radicals, if left unregulated, can damage all components of a cell, including its proteins, lipids, and DNA. And when our DNA is damaged, the body isn't always able to repair it or isn't capable of repairing it properly, which can lead to compromised functions or mutations. And if it is serious enough, the mutation can develop into cancer. And the lack of function will result in accelerated cellular aging. The researchers wanted to take this investigation into the link between DNA damage and coffee consumption further by looking into the effects of the popular beverage. This is a really long-winded story. Strand breakage occurs when one or both strands of DNA double helix are pulled apart and can sometimes be smashed together again with different types of broken DNA, causing genome rearrangements. And in some cases, this promotes the growth of cancer cells. The team, led by, oh my goodness, T. Bacharach from the University of Kaiserslautern. Where on earth is that? Kaiserslautern. Enlisted 84 men between the ages of 19 and 50 who had healthy weights and diets, were non-smokers, and did not use drugs or alcohol on a regular basis. The volunteers were asked to consume either 3 cups of fresh brewed coffee or plain water every day for 4 weeks, one in the morning, one at noon, and one in the afternoon. The coffee was a special roast, blended Arabica, my favorite, and was served black, and the volunteers were given the option of having a teaspoon of sugar. Other caffeinated products were also avoided during this time, and before and after the coffee water consumption phase, spontaneous DNA strand breaks were measured. The research described what they found. It was published in the European Journal of Nutrition. Quote, the baseline, both groups exhibited a similar level of spontaneous DNA strand breaks. In the intervention phase, spontaneous DNA strand breaks slightly increased in the control, which was the water-only group, where they significantly decreased in the coffee group, leading to a 27% difference. Food frequency questionnaires indicated no differences in the overall diet between the group, and mean body weight during the intervention phases all remained stable. The consumption of coffee substantially lowered the level of spontaneous DNA strand breaks in white blood cells. So there you go, people. 3 cups a day. I don't know if I could do one in the afternoon, but morning and noon is fine with me. It says these results correlate to findings of previous research, one from 2007 that included 38 participants and showed marked protection against oxidative DNA damage after just 5 days of consuming freshly brewed coffee, and another experiment from 2010 showing a slight reduction of oxidative DNA strand breaks in the volunteers' lymphocytes after drinking instant coffee. Taken together, the observed DNA protective effects associated with coffee consumption may be considered a benefit to human health. Do, do, do. All right, guys, we are at the end of the show. I made it 25 seconds. All right, it is Thursday, so Mr. Kevin Blanche is live up next. And then we have Thursday night, Mr. Chuck O'Chelly is live at 6 p.m. Eastern. Then we have Hal Anthony's latest episode that ran on Sunday will be running. And then Chuck and Drew at 10 p.m. Eastern, followed up with S.M. Gibson and Diedrich Young at 11 p.m. Eastern. All right, everybody, have a happy Thursday. Stay warm out there. It's going to get colder. And we will catch up with you tomorrow. Everyone, take care.